This week on the Allegheny Front, we'll hear voices on the environment from vastly different places. We talk to a writer in the coalfields of Kentucky and go on an expedition with a sound artist capturing vibrations at the bottom of the Allegheny River. Plus, we ask the big questions to a scientist who studies life in New Guinea and who also happens to have a Pulitzer.
Good heavens, the United States is a success story that nevertheless is at risk of screwing things up.
I'm Kara Holsapple. Join us for some of our favorite interviews. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. President Trump has been promising to revive the coal industry and put miners back to work since all the way back in the early days of his campaign. And even though a lot of the downturn of jobs in the industry has been caused by modernization and the cheap price of natural gas, Trump is adamant.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Going to have clean coal, really clean coal.
Well, writer Silas House knows coal. He grew up in the hills of eastern Kentucky, and through his work, he describes life in coal country with complex characters steeped in history and tradition. But as the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found out in this interview from our series, The Future of Coal, House isn't only an observer. He's also an activist in the fight against mountaintop removal coal mining.
Well, I grew up in a coal mining family, in a coal mining community. Most all the men in my family worked in the mines in some capacity. My father didn't, and I didn't, but most everybody else did. And, you know, you just grow up, it's a culture unto itself, and it's something that you're very proud to be a part of. We knew that we were supplying energy to the United States, to the world. We knew that it was hard work, and it took, you know, tough people to do it. But we were also really aware of the environmental impact it had on our community. When I was about 11, I guess, a huge strip mine moved in across the road from our house. And for the next 2 years, that sort of took over our lives. You know, we breathed the dust. We heard the blast. It changed that community forever. And that had a real, I don't know, lasting impression on me. It made me aware of how double-edged that sword was, you know, of growing up, being really proud of being from that coal mining legacy. My grandfather lost his leg in the coal mines and recuperated 6 months and went right back in. He counted his colleagues in the mines as his brothers, you know, and so it's a really complex thing, a really love-hate relationship. Coal brought my family up out of deep poverty, but at the same time, my family and people in my community and my place have really paid the price.
So I wanted to ask you about your own entry into activism. When did you become an activist against mountaintop removal? And I wanted you to talk about why.
Even when I was a little boy, when the big strip mine first moved in, I was constantly wanting to challenge them. And, you know, I wanted my parents to complain more about it to the county and to the state. And I just saw how much damage it was doing to our road and to our water. It completely changed the landscape. And so in 2005, Wendell Berry contacted me and 14 other Kentucky writers. By that time, I had two novels out. And, you know, when Wendell Berry calls you and asks you to do something, you do it. And Wendell said, I want you to go on a tour with me of eastern Kentucky, and we're going to look at mountaintop removal sites. And I knew all about strip mining. I knew about deep mining, and I felt like I knew the coal industry pretty well. But I really, even living amongst it, didn't understand mountaintop removal and how different that was and how devastating it was.
What's the reaction been like in eastern Kentucky to some of your writing and some of your activism?
People will write to me and thank me for speaking out and for being vocal about it. And then some people, you know, tell me that I'm a traitor to my own place, to my own people. That's a really hurtful thing, you know, to hear because I care so deeply. I have a sticker on my back window that says I'm a friend of miners and mountains. And so, you know, every time I talk about coal and the devastating aspects of coal, I always want to talk about my deep respect for the coal miners, for the people who do the really hard work. When I'm talking about being against coal, I'm talking about being against these huge corporations that, you know, don't think about balance. They don't think about the communities that they're harming. And for the most part, they don't think about their miners, their employees. You know, it's all numbers game.
You've, in your writings, you've called mountaintop removal not just an environmental issue, but a human issue as well. I was just wondering if you could explain what you mean by that.
As an Appalachian, you're told all of your life that you're worthless, that you are throwaway people, that you don't really matter. You see Appalachians on TV, and they're always portrayed as stupid, lazy, small-minded. You know, I mean, it's always a negative portrayal. No matter the pride that your family and your community instills in you, some little part of you believes that. Something like mountaintop removal, the companies use that. They feed into that, and it's very cultural. They know that one of the things that we have always had to be proud of is coal mining. So anybody who questions that in any way is attacked. You know, they're told they're a traitor, they're not a patriot, et cetera, et cetera. And all those things. Most of the people I know who've been active in the fight against mountaintop removal have had death threats, and, you know, I've had threatening letters sent to me about my children, et cetera, et cetera.
And what was your reaction to that?
I think that it made me realize, really, I was speaking out because of my children more than anything else, because I wanted them to have clean water. I wanted them to be able to, you know, be from a place they could be proud of, that they could bring people to, and it not be utter ruin. If anything, you know, it solidified my passion for the issue. It's never gone out of my mind. I've never stopped worrying about it. But, you know, you just choose if you're going to use it for the negative or the positive in those instances. And I think it made me more forceful, and it rallied a lot of people.
Silas House is a writer and activist from Kentucky. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier as part of our series, The Future of Coal. You can hear more of their interview at AlleghenyFront.org. The sounds of waves and ripples on the shore or bumping up against the side of a boat can be soothing. But what's going on beneath the surface of the water?
What I hear most often in these recordings are metallic noises. They're very tingy.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, a sound artist lowers a microphone into a river and discovers new territory. Stay tuned. Jared Diamond rarely walks through an airport without the following scene playing out.
There was a father with two children who recognized me and said, "Are you Jared Diamond?" Then he came over and said, "Your books changed my life."
Diamond is a geography professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and he does have a very distinctive beard. But his fans know him as the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Third Chimpanzee, and many other popular science books. Diamond says people respond to his books this way because they focus on the big issues of life that everybody's concerned with: survival, sex, and why history turned out the way it did. Diamond recently spoke in Pittsburgh, and I got a chance to talk with him about some of those themes in his most recent books. The World Until Yesterday asks the question, what can we learn from traditional societies? First, can you say what you mean by traditional societies and talk a little bit about how you researched the book?
Traditional societies are every society in the world for the last 6 million years until the last few thousand years, when we started getting governments, armies, presidents, and industries and all the resulting changes. Traditional societies today, there still are some. There are tribal societies in New Guinea, where I do my field work, in the Amazon, and then all around the world, even so-called modern societies have traditional elements. For example, in Montana, where I have a summer vacation every year, there's a lot that's traditional in Montana. If you have an argument with your neighbor Montana rancher, you don't get lawyers. You deal with it in the traditional manner by trying to talk it out.
What can we learn, then, from traditional societies, especially about living in an ecosystem without, as you say, romanticizing them? I'm thinking of the chapters on danger in the environment and also health.
There are so many things we can learn from traditional societies because, in effect, they are thousands of experiments on how to run a human society. Some of the things that they do seem to us terrible and are terrible, like being trapped in constant warfare. Some of the things that some of them do strike me and others as wonderful, such as how they stay healthy, how they don't die of heart attacks, stroke, diabetes, like never, and how they bring up their children and their attitudes towards danger. Things that have most affected me in my work with New Guinea tribal societies for the last 55 years now has been seeing how they bring up their children to make their own decisions, to make their own choices, to be independent and not to have helicopter parents. So when our children were born, my wife and I brought them up not like New Guineans who send their children off to the jungle to deal with snakes, but we nevertheless gave our kids a lot more autonomy than is usual in the United States. A result was that at age 3, speak of snakes, one of our sons saw his first snake. It was dead. It was love at first sight. He said he wanted snakes as a pet. My wife and I are not snake lovers, but there's a boy making a choice, and so we got him a snake and then another snake, and he gradually built up to 147 pet snakes and frogs and lizards and reptiles, and he got used to making his choices. And then one day, just after he graduated college, he called us up to say that he had decided what he wanted to do for a career. He said he decided he wanted to be a chef. That's just an example of how we brought up our kids in New Guinea style to make their own choices.
Yeah, kids in New Guinea are allowed to climb trees, which is kind of frowned upon these days in the U.S.
That's the least of it, of course. Good heavens, of course. Of course they're allowed to climb trees. The idea that your kid wouldn't climb a tree, it's unthinkable. Not only are they allowed to climb trees, they're allowed to swim in rivers with crocodiles carefully. They're allowed to run off into the jungle and spend as much time as they want. Again, they make their choices.
Collapse, how societies choose to fail or succeed, is also informed by your time in New Guinea. What are the environmental factors that can lead to a failed society?
What are the environmental factors that can lead to a failed society?
Just one or two.
That's like asking me, what are the personal factors that can lead to a failed marriage? And a brief answer is everything. Everything that you can do wrong can lead to a failed marriage. And similarly, the environmental factors that can lead to a failed society are: you can fail to manage your forest problems. There was starting to be a problem in the highlands of New Guinea. You can fail to manage your fish problems. That's been a problem off the east coast of the United States with the cod fishery. Anything that you can do wrong, humans have managed to do wrong. Famous collapses of society right in the United States, in what is now the United States, the two most advanced Native American societies before Columbus's arrival were the Anasazi, based at Chaco Canyon in the Four Corners area of New Mexico. They had big problems with water management, which for a long time they solved. They also had problems of obtaining sufficient timber in a very dry environment. And for several centuries, they managed brilliantly, but they were eventually done in by a drought. That's the Anasazi, with the result that today we have Anasazi ruins, and we don't know what language they spoke, and yet they had the tallest skyscrapers in the United States until the skyscrapers of the Central Loop of Chicago in the 1880s.
So I guess it's easier to look back on a society and sort of look at the factors that might have led to their collapse. It's harder when you're in the moment. Is there something that people 100 years from now, 1,000, I don't know, 1,000 years from now, if that's possible, might look back and see something that we're doing here in the U.S. and say, well, that's what led to their ultimate demise?
For sure, except for two things. One is it's uncertain whether there will be anybody around 100 or 1,000 years from now.
Right, I was trying to be optimistic.
let's instead be realistic and talk about 30 years from now. And as for your question, asking for one thing that we did wrong, the answer is no, there isn't one thing that we did wrong. Everything that's possible to do wrong, someone or other is doing it wrong. Our environmental policy is the opposite of a sane environmental policy. Our jobs and education and science policy have taken disastrous turns. So yes, 30 years from now, we will either have solved those problems, or if there are people 30 years from now, they will say they did this, this, and this wrong. How could they have been so stupid?
Well, okay, so which societies have succeeded because of their relationship with the natural resources or the environment? How can we save ours? How can we learn by their example?
Lots of societies have succeeded, among them Iceland, the island in the middle of the North Atlantic, a really fragile environment. Pittsburgh is anything but a fragile environment. It's fertile soils, it's temperate zone, it's plenty of rainfalls, forests, etc. But Iceland is a volcanic environment with strong winds. It's easy for soil to get blown away, and the Icelanders ran into big problems until after a century they realized that their soil was being blown off, and they had to manage their environment carefully by regulating sheep grazing and when the sheep moved up into the pasture. There's one success story. Other success stories today, many of the countries of Northern Europe, Norway, Sweden, Finland, are managing their environments quite well. My beloved New Guinea, New Guineans discovered that they were deforesting their environment about 1,000 years ago, and they figured out how to have sustainable agroforestry by planting casuarina trees, which are native to New Guinea, in their villages. So they got enough timber and construction and firewood from trees growing right in their villages. Those are among the success stories far away. There are also success stories in our time. The United States, good heavens, the United States is the richest country in the world. The United States is a success story that nevertheless is at risk of screwing things up.
As a scientist and a communicator of a broad range of scientific topics, how important is scientific literacy in the general public? And what role do popular science books like many of yours play, or would you want them to play?
This is a democracy. Ultimately, what gets done is what the public wants. Either politicians think they know what the public wants, or the public says what it wants. That means that our science policy depends upon public choice. But if the public doesn't understand science, we're going to mess up science. But science is simply knowledge of the real world. And if our public doesn't understand the real world, they're going to operate as if it's an unreal world. They can operate as if the world is flat, which it isn't. They can operate as if climate change is the biggest lie that was ever recounted, which it isn't. Those are reasons why we need popular science. We need the public to have an understanding.
Jared Diamond is an award-winning author and scientist, and his recent appearance in Pittsburgh was sponsored by Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program, made possible through a grant from the Heinz Endowments. And we should say that the Allegheny Front is also supported in part by the Heinz Endowments. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Coming up on the Trump on Earth podcast, President Trump orders a review of the nation's public lands. Can he undo generations of protections?
I'm wishing I would have brought my Teddy Roosevelt and I could be quoting scripture from Roosevelt about the national significance. You got me riled up.
How the administration and Congress want to increase coal and natural gas development on federal lands. That's coming up on the Trump on Earth podcast from the Allegheny Front and Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. Listen at trumponearth.org.
Finally this week, we're revisiting an interview from last fall, where I went to the North Shore of the Allegheny River in Pittsburgh to do some fishing. But not for fish. Here's that story.
We picked a beautiful day to go sound fishing.
Is that what you call it?
That's what I'm calling it right now. Yeah, Yeah. But literally, yes. We're going to throw a hydrophone into the Allegheny River and see what we can come up with.
That's Ricardo Iamuri Robinson, a field recordist, composer, performer. He wears a lot of hats. Actually, today he's wearing a red jumpsuit.
My supersonic uniform.
It's not waterproof, I asked. Anyway, today we're under the Fort Duquesne Bridge at the edge of the water. It's just after rush hour, but cars are still moving at a clip above our heads. People are riding their bikes on a trail behind us. Robinson pulls a rolled-up yellow cord out of his bag, and at the end is the hydrophone, a mic that's designed to withstand the water.
I like the architecture on this one. Kind of looks like a stethoscope, you know. All right, so I'm going to throw this on in here.
He threads the cable through his fingers, then turns on the recorder it's plugged into, and puts on his headphones.
It's pretty crazy. What's interesting about the majority of the hydrophone recordings that I've done in rivers, I wanted to hear more of those flush, something more gargly. But what I hear most often in these recordings are metallic noises. They're very tingy.
Robinson collects sounds like these for his library. They could be used in films, video games, or art installations.
Okay. I'm going to throw it out a little bit more.
He gets down on his stomach, flush with the concrete.
It's cool for you to come out here with me. I'm working on two projects, finding certain spaces throughout Pittsburgh that are of historical interest to me, and creating audio tours designed for that specific space. So I'm really interested in what I would call the sonic evolution of space, what it once sounded like before industry and technology arrived, what it presently sounds like, and what it will someday sound like. It's just very interesting to me that with development and this thing we call progress also comes a soundtrack, you know.
He calls it sonarchaeology, sound archaeology. It's the name of his business and really his personal philosophy.
What's the difference between what's happening down there at the moment and what's happening up here?
I would love for you to like put the headphones on and check it out.
So we switch headphones. Oh, wow.
How would you describe that?
It is reminiscent of a bathtub, like a huge bathtub. You can kind of get the scope of how big it is. It really does sound like another world.
I think you're absolutely right. It's so interesting that something just like us kind of lives and speaks its own language and changes. And I love that. I love like documenting that.
Later that day, after we've reeled in the hydrophone, I meet Robinson back at the studios where the Allegheny Front is produced. So now we're back at the studio and we can hear each other speaking.
Very clearly.
Let's listen to what we got today.
Okay.
So that's what we recorded. It was beneath the water with the hydrophone.
Yes. So
What do you think?
There are certain parts of the recording that I absolutely love.
Like what?
When there is the clicking and the clacking kind of takes a back seat and no longer wants to be the solo artist and joins into the whole ecology of what's going on down there.
And the clacking and the clicking, you think, is just the microphone hitting things, or is there vibrations?
For sure. But there are certain little, you know, going on down there, which I have no idea what that is. Allegheny River merman just swimming down there. I have no idea.
So what do you imagine it might sound like in the future?
Whatever is happening outside of the river is definitely going to have an impact on what's going on underneath. So what will it sound like in the future? I don't see flying cars, but I do see the sound of cars changing. I do see the material of the bridges, a new type of material to maintain these structures, which will create a new sonic relationship. I'm not going to say the whole river's going to be pristine and clean. I doubt that's going to happen. There's just been too much industry.
Where are some of the other places you've recorded, like outside in nature, or where nature runs up against
the built environment, and mm-hmm. where's been your favorite place to record, maybe outside?
How are we defining nature?
That's a good question, because nature could be in an urban landscape as well as out in the forest.
See, I have this theory. So I'm watching the bird, and I'm like, you know, that bird is amazing, you know, creating this nest. Dams, you know, where there's all of these different life forms using resources around them to create these new structures or sculptures, beehives. That's their nature. We did the same thing. It's just, I think I call it unnatural when you create something that is self-destructive. And then it's like, wait, was that your intention, you know, to make yourself sick? Then we're going into the unnatural world. So for me, it's all nature, and it's hard for me to distinguish sometimes, but I love traveling to the ocean. That is one of my sanctuaries. It's so vociferous. It's just, you know, and it's speaking. This is one sound that seems permanent.
So when you're out recording,
yes,
what are you listening for?
I think I am looking for something. And I think it's silence. I've never experienced silence. This could be a semantic argument, you know, because we use the word a lot in just everyday vernacular. But for me, silence is something that's kind of beyond activity. So when I'm listening, I'm kind of trying to go as far as I can. They are meditative for me to just sit out in the forest or near the ocean or even listening to traffic. It doesn't annoy me anymore. I can really go within myself and listen to the different frequencies and listen to the different pitches, you know, throw my hands in the air and conduct this sort of, you know, amazing thing that's happening, this combustion of sound. But I think there is this interest in where did it all come from? Do you know what's going on?
Do I know what's going on?
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess that's what you're here for.
It's a man's search for meaning. It's all there.
So yeah. Is that what you want other people to hear?
If we have that gift of hearing, let's slow down. Let's be present. Sound is very deep. We live in an acoustic world. Psychoacoustics is real. It does impact your psychology. Sounds can change your mood, can inspire you to feel, you know, what we would label as joy or happiness. So I would love to invite people to surrender in that moment.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for, yeah, having me here. It's been awesome.
Ricardo Iamuri Robinson is a field recordist, composer, and artist. You can find out more about his work at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.